Hi, this is Bruce Ryder, Five Finger Death Punch, and you're listening to the Jay Franzi Show.
Welcome to the Jay Franzi Show, a behind-the-curtain look at the entertainment industry with insights you can't pay for and stories you've never heard. Now, here's your host, Jay Franzi.
Well, thank you for joining me and welcome to the show. I am Jay Franzi, and if you are new here, this is where we take a deep dive into the entertainment industry to provide you with valuable insights and entertaining stories. This week, we get to talk with a seasoned songwriter and producer. We get to talk with T.W. Hale. We'll talk to him about his transition from jingle writing to songwriting, what it was like writing songs for Reba McEntire, Billy Ray Cyrus, and Joe Diffie, and we'll take a deep dive into his partnership with Tom Harding. Now, T.W. has not only written for some of Nashville's finest artists, but he's also collaborated with some of the greatest writers and engineers in town. He's traveled an amazing path, and I can't wait to talk with him about it tonight. So if you'd like to join in, comment, or fire off any questions, please head over to jfranzi.com. Now let's get started. T.W., sir, how are you?
I am most excellent. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. I am very excited for tonight. We get to talk about one of the things I am most passionate about, and that is music.
It's one of my favorite things to talk about.
But before we get to Nashville, you're from Texas.
Well, I grew up in Texas, and of course, Texas is its own nation. But yeah, I grew up there and, you know, grew up in the country and drove tractors, baled hay, and did all this stuff. And then one day I picked up a guitar and sang for some people, and the next thing you know, I was making more money playing guitar than I was baling hay. So I thought, well, let's do this for a little while longer. I said, I want to know more about the business. So I went into arranging, vocal arranging, big band arranging, you know, composition, songwriting, all that stuff. Went to Dallas, began playing in bands there and jingle writing and singing in the studio, what have you. Moved to L.A. and then moved from L.A. to Nashville. So I've been kind of bouncing around everywhere.
And you said that led you into jingle writing before you left Texas?
Yeah, because I'd always been arranging. I'd been a vocalist. I'd always been a piano player, guitar player. Well, not only do you write them, they put a group together, and then they take you in the studio and you start singing. So I got real early, got into singing in the studio with other people as a group and also as a solo. For a while, I was the voice of the army in Texas for a while, be all you can be guy.
Well, that's pretty cool. What was that like for you? Did you enjoy doing it?
You know, I did love it. That was my problem. I loved being in the studio. I like being, and I love playing, but man, I love the studio. And so anytime I could write or arrange or get in the studio, man, I was there.
I'm with you. I always enjoyed being in the studio. Mm-hmm. But you said you were the voice of the army at the time. So
yeah, one small commercial I was there for, you know, it was kind of fun. And just be all you can be, man. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. So then you head over to L.A.
Yeah.
What made you make that move?
A girl.
Well, that's how it happens.
It happens, doesn't it? So I met a girl there in Dallas while I was playing. And she's an actress. And, of course, she says, I'm going to L.A. See ya. For like a year and a half or so, long-distance phone bills and flying back and forth on airplanes because we owed everybody just to see each other. And then finally, I just moved out there and we got married.
What was the music scene like there for you?
A little different than being around Texas, obviously, because Texas is such a genre thing. But out in L.A. as a songwriter, it's so spread out. Trying to find that group of writers to hang with and do stuff with and that kind of thing, it's harder to do in L.A. I found it hard to do just because, like I say, everybody's spread out everywhere. But got into doing some of that and got into a couple of band leadership things. I got into a leader of a band for Grant Goodeve, who played the oldest son on Eight Is Enough, which is a really old reference television show.
It was a great show, though.
Yeah, we played all over the place. And when I wasn't playing in there, I was in a house band with Jeffrey Steele. And he and I played out there in Orange County for the country stuff. Yeah, it was a blast.
Yeah, Orange County is not a bad place to be for a little while.
Yeah.
So how long did you spend out there before you made your next move?
I was probably out there 2.5 years. And then while I was going back and forth from there to Nashville, trying to get a publishing deal. And then I said, you know, I'm going to go out to L.A. She's out there. She's working. I can write songs. And I had a friend who was a set designer for one of the major TV stations. And he said, man, won't you just get on the union and I'll teach you how to build sets, because I was a pretty good carpenter. So I was kind of went back out there thinking I would do that. And then about 4 days into being out there, I got a phone call from Nashville going, hey, man, I got your music on my desk. I love this. Would you want to sign? So now I have to decide, am I going to leave the girl I'm married to and come back out to Nashville? So we split for a little while. I mean, we were still married, but she lived there and worked, and I lived here and went back to flying back and forth for a while.
That had to be a hard decision. What was that like for you?
It was tough. It was tough. We're a pretty strong relationship, and we were able to make that work just by constant working at it. And then finally one day, and she was having a pretty bad day in acting, and she said, you know, maybe we should start looking at having babies. And I said, well, maybe we should start looking at living in the same city. So that's what we started talking about. You know, you want to have babies, we got to kind of be closer together. So anyway, so that's what we did. And then she moved out here to Nashville, I think 1987.
That's my time.
Yeah.
So you're, I graduated high school.
Well, there you go.
So she moves out to Nashville. Do you remember what publishing company it was that you signed with?
Yes, it was Life of the Record Music, a small independent publishing company. The owner's name was Johnny Rutenshore. And at the claim to fame at the time, he had an artist named Tim Malchak. So he had some success with Tim and wanted to add a writer to his roster. And Tim and I had written and got along. So I signed there, and I think I wrote there for 5 years.
Oh, wow.
And from there, moved on to different places.
Did anything come out of your first five-year stint there?
First 5 years, I got the Reba cut. Why Haven't I Heard From You? My first cut, which I'm still just pleased and proud of, is a song that Gene Watson cut called Snake in the House. And that was my very first ever single here in Nashville. And I loved that. And from there, just kept going and going and going. And then during that time, like I say, got the Reba cut.
So when you finally get that first cut, you hear it on the radio, you finally feel like you've made it, like something's finally happened for you?
Sure. After the shock, it's the first time I heard it on the radio. I was driving with my wife, and at that time we had a 2-year-old daughter, and we were in a Cracker Barrel on our way to Texas, and just so happened that whatever they were playing, radio or whatever, played my song.
At the Cracker Barrel.
At the Cracker Barrel, yeah. And I stood up and nearly spilled every glass of water and coffee and everything on the table. So my wife, Deborah, said, sit down.
Wives, they just don't understand.
I know. But it was fun. It's great to hear it always.
Very cool. So that gets the ball rolling for you. And then you said Reba came next?
Yeah, Reba was in that year, several other small things. And then from that, moved over to Pure Music and did several things there, and then had a Joe Diffie cut there, Night to Remember. And then we did that for 5 years, and there were some other cuts, some European cuts and some other things that were going on. And then, there was some Randy Travis, 2 or 3 things there. And then after that, I left and started a little publishing company with an investor, and we had Billy Ray Cyrus single and 2 or 3 things.
Yeah.
Now I kind of am my own publisher.
Which is a great place to be.
It is. And
Billy Ray Cyrus, he was a super nice guy as well.
He is an extremely nice guy.
So that first cut you did for Reba, do you remember how it happened?
Sure, yeah. I wrote the song with one of my dearest friends, Sandy Knox, great singer in her own right, an artist in her own right. We had gone in and cut it, Billy Hullett's studio, and brought horns in. I mean, basically when you hear Reba sing the song, she sang the demo. Because it had the horns on it, it had the background vocals on it, it had everything. And so then we pitched it, and she came up and says, I love this song, I'd like to put it on hold. We went, we would love for you to put it on hold. Please, right. Put it on hold. So she was going to cut during the summer. She'd been on the road. And this album, she was going to let the band play on the record instead of hiring session players, because they're such all great players anyway. Well, on the road, now this is a story I heard. I'm going to say it's true, but I don't know. When they went in to cut it, "Why Haven't I Heard From You?" because it's a 12-bar blues, sounded a lot like "Take It Back." And the band who'd been playing "Take It Back" all year long on the road, every time they played "Why Haven't I Heard From You," it really sounded more like the other song. And so she called the office and said, "Hey, we're not going to cut the song." And we all in the office went,
right.
And she said, but this was like in July or August. She goes, "I'm going to do another album in January. Can I hold it till then?" We said, "Sure, absolutely." And then in January, she came back and cut it, and it made it to the album. So, yeah, it was fun.
Wow, that must have been quite a shock at the time.
Oh, gosh. We were all just, we held our breath forever. It's like 6 months we didn't breathe.
Right.
And then January came in and cut it, and we went, well, it's on the record. It probably won't be a single because they're going to say it sounds too much like this. And then the next thing you know, it was a single. And we went, really? Okay, take it.
How well did it do?
I think it topped out at 5. I wanted it to go to number one, as every songwriter does.
Of course.
But I think it topped at 5. It paid like it was number one, but it's still not the same as having that number one.
Right.
Yeah. But it was good. It was fun. And it was not going to be a single, the story goes, because promotion people going, "What sounds too much like that other song?" And she'd just written her book, and she was doing all the book tours going in, and she had to sing two songs, a ballad and an up-tempo. And she wanted to sing "My Song Is the Up-Tempo." And so she just told the marketing people at the record label, "No, this is the next single." So she released it, and she stood up for it. So I'm so glad she did. She's a great person.
That's incredible. Did you produce the demo?
Well, Sandy and I produced the demo. Bill Howitt was the primary person on the demo. It was Bill Howitt's studio. He played guitar, acoustic, and electric on it. And because it was his studio and he knew the horn players and he knew all the stuff, he pretty much ran with it then. So I'm going to say Billy Hullett probably had more to do with it than anybody. I'd like to take credit, but not me.
Right. What year was that? That was mid-90s?
Yeah, it was. Had to be, yeah.
Was Jeff King playing with Reba at that time?
I don't think so. I think Jeff was still heavy in the session world at that time.
The reason I thought of that is when you said that, I know he's a session player, but he goes on the road with her. And when you said that she was using her band, I was just curious if he was one of those people from that band.
You know, I'm not sure who was in that band at the time. I know he played later. And I know that all the time I was doing demos here in town, he was always on the sessions. So he was playing with her. He was getting in and out fast, you know, to come play.
Yeah. So then you switch publishing companies.
Yeah.
Why'd you do that?
I think after a while, 5 years somewhere, and you're either feeling like you're moving forward or you're standing still. And while I loved where I was, and Johnny Rutenshaw was a great guy and loved working with him, I just felt like it was a change. I had a buddy of mine in Texas that was a guy who produced Broadway plays, and he came to town, and we went out to dinner, and this talk led to that talk, and the next thing you know, he's going, "Man, let's do a publishing company." And I was going, "Wait a minute." I said, "We need somebody to be the publisher. I'm the guy writing the songs. I don't want to do that." We partnered with Pure Music so that we could do a co-pub with them, and they handled all that stuff, and I got to write and produce.
That's pretty cool. So when that came about, how did you convince them to partner up with you?
I knew what my investor wanted out of it, which was, you know, was a co-pub deal with the other publisher. Then they got together and talked about, okay, who's going to cover the draw? Who's going to cover the demo cost? Will he have an office? Who's going to be plugging for your company? Because really, my buddy was the money man more than anything. He paid my draw and demo stuff. And then they did all the physical pitching and the oversight of the copyright and everything. So it was a co-publishing deal with them.
Was that a 50-50 split at that time?
Yeah, for those guys, it was 50-50 to do that. I still had all my songwriting, but they split the publishing.
All right. So what was the first big hit during that time?
There were several, but the biggest one probably was the Joe Diffie hit, A Night to Remember.
That's pretty cool. Do you have any say in the recording of that project?
Max T. Barnes and I wrote it, and he and I produced it and sent it to him. And then it turns out it was actually on hold for someone else, and they cut it. And then they went on the road, and they called their producer back and went, "Hey, I think I missed it on this demo, and I'd like to re-sing it." And the producer said, "We don't have time. You've overcut." So it goes on the project like it is, or it's off. And so they took it off, which, again, everybody went, you know. And then the next thing you know, I got a call from a buddy of mine, Lonnie Wilson, who was producing Joe Diffie at the time, great drummer. He's an extremely great drummer and producer.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He said, "Hey, dude, we're cutting your song." And I said, "Thank you, Lonnie."
So he was part of the recording of that tune?
Yeah, he was the producer on Joe's project on that CD.
I wasn't aware he was a producer. I know he's a drummer. I've worked with him on several sessions, but I didn't realize he was producing projects as well.
Yeah, he's just been working on the new Wade Hayes thing.
So when he called you and told you that, then all of a sudden, like the Reba thing, things just change again?
Yeah, oh yeah, man. Anytime you get a cut, you just jump up and down and have a good time, you know, but then you find out one of your buddies is going to be producing it and you're going, "This is even better." So yeah, anytime you get a cut, jump up and down. And I don't care what size it is. Just get a cut.
Did you go in the studio at all during that time when they were cutting it?
I didn't go to any of their project while they were down there. He would send stuff to me and go, "Hey, what do you think of this?" You know, and I go, "It rocks, man." You
know. So when that went out there, did it do well?
Yeah, I seem to have a lot of fives. It went to number five.
Roadblock at five.
Yeah, it seems like the whole thing gets to five. And it's funny because even back on the Reba thing, when it was at five, it probably would have gone to one, except the song that radio started playing was another one of the songs on her project. They had some great political statement to it, and man, radio jumped on it. The record label didn't put it out, they just jumped on it. And so right. When they did that, timing. It kind of stole the thunder from the five on the Reba thing. But
yeah. No, I get that. So you and your partner, you have some success. So does that now put a little life into your joint venture there, and do you continue moving forward with it?
Absolutely, yeah. At that point, we were all jumping up and down, and you know, by then we had an office and had a song plugger and looking at other catalogs and doing all that. So we did that for about 3.5 years, and he had also produced a lot of stuff on Broadway, and at that time he was producing the Seussical on Broadway. So he was real wrapped up in that and everything was going on. And after about 3.5-4 years, he and I sat down again over dinner or somewhere. And then he said, "Man, what do you think? You got your feet on the ground?" I said, "Absolutely." He goes, "Okay, I'm going to go back to New York and do that." So that's kind of where we parted our ways. And I just kept doing my thing for a while. And that's how I got where I am now.
So you obviously continued to do it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Did the success keep coming in?
Well, I mean, I think success has come, yes. I mean, not as big. I haven't had anything as big as the number fives, but I'm getting stuff all the time. And now I'm kind of having more fun producing a bunch of independent artists, you know, than just helping people get there, you know. Got a lot of stuff happening in Europe.
Yeah, I can see that, too.
Yeah.
I spent, you know, 20-ish years in Nashville doing records, working with some of the bigger producers and working on these projects that everybody would know.
Yep.
But it's the independent ones that I had a chance to produce myself that I felt were most memorable to me.
Sure.
I feel like there was less restraint, and I feel like we were able to do things and try things, and it was a little bit more experimental.
Yeah, they don't seem to get locked up in all that major label stuff.
Right. You're partnering up there too, aren't you?
Yeah, I have a production company started with Tom Harding, and it's called H2 Productions. We've been producing a lot of independent acts. We just finished a group from the 80s called The Girls Next Door. They had Slow Boat to China. And they all came back together and said, "Man, we've been away from it for 30 years. We want to do another project." So we sat down with them and said, okay, let's look at what you want to do. So we started gathering songs and looking at a direction, went into the studio and got a whole new project with them. So it was fun. I think they've got a song right now, number 4 on the European charts.
That's pretty cool. So how much time did you spend on that project?
Let's see, we started that in probably 1st of October last year, because they all live in different cities. We have one lady that lives in Oklahoma, and one in South Carolina, one in Murfreesboro, right outside of Nashville, and one in Franklin, Tennessee. So trying to get them all together to sing and get in the studio was always fun.
That's a challenge within itself.
It was. But we started that and got all the songs, got all the tracks, and then finished things up in the spring of this year. We did 7 songs. And they're doing great. Sounds great, too. They can sing. It's amazing.
Still.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it's nice, tight, 4-part harmony.
That's awesome. Well, I know Tom was on the show. I know he talked about recording some heavier music. Do you work with him on those type of projects?
Yes. He did the band Lost Circus. Really great band. And I went over and helped him with some vocals and some guitar stuff. He and I are looking at another band that we're looking at doing, another kind of rock band. So Tom is the rock and roll part of the thing.
Right. But
between the two of us, we can cover everything.
That's funny that you mentioned it that way. I had Jim Cristaldi was on the show a while back as well, and I partnered up with him on a couple records where I was more of the rock guy and he was the country guy, and together we got together and we were able to put together some pretty cool projects. At least I thought they were.
Yeah.
When you're working with Tom like that, you know, what's that relationship like?
Well, Tom is one of the best. Golly, cutting tracks, the guy's unbelievable at recording all his tracks and stuff. His drum mics and all the stuff. And I love it when he does that because I don't have to think about it. I mean, I want to be the creative guy, and he's the guy that goes, wait, that mic should be 6 inches over there, you know, and he does this move thing, and it just sounds great. And what do you think about doing this? And he brings his rock and roll into it and goes, well, let's try this. And then we'll have a rock thing, and I go, well, what if we bring accordion in over here and, you know, put something through it? And we just start playing with all the different stuff from wherever we come from. But he's such a great music guy, and he does things in the studio that's phenomenal. You know, I just think it's great.
That's pretty cool. So are you doing it at his place, or are you guys renting studios?
We rent studios for the tracks, and occasionally we'll rent some studios for vocals if we need to. And then he's got a studio at his house so we can do vocals. I've got a studio here that we can do vocals. We try to cut the main stuff in a room, and then from there we spread out. Some artists sing better in a studio. Some sing better in a home. Just kind of have to know your artist.
Yeah, no, that's true. And sometimes, you know, you just have that time, the freedom when you're at your own place.
Yep.
So
yep.
Do you have a particular studio in town that you like to use?
Well, there's been a lot I like. Of course, the new project, we've got Omni booked. A lot of stuff I do demo-wise and some independent projects I've cut at Lonnie Wilson's studio, which is Freeway Sound. And it's a great place to get sounds. Of course, you got Lonnie Wilson on drums. What do you want? But then he brings in everybody, and it's just phenomenal. And it's cost-effective for what we do. You know, when you're doing a project that doesn't have a lot of money, then you find a high-quality studio that will do a fair price for you. And Lonnie's place is great for that.
I can only imagine, too, that his drum kit is set up at all times.
All the time.
Ready to go. So the placement in the room is probably already taken care of. The mics are probably already set up. Yep. And he just sits down and plays.
That's it. And it is a phenomenal drum sound.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
He is absolutely killer, too.
He is. He's got the hardest snare in Nashville. That's what I always tell Tom. We'll hear something, I go, that's a Lonnie Wilson snare. You know, you just kind of get to where you can tell it.
So now that you're doing a lot of production in addition to everything else, do you find that that's affecting your songwriting at all?
I think it does affect it because when you get in the middle of a project and you're working on vocals and you're doing all the detail work that it takes, it kind of takes that kind of focus. And so the creative part that gets to sit on and stare at a blank piece of paper kind of gets sucked into studio world. So it's a balance. If I'm really like in the depth of doing what we were doing with the Girls Next Door, which was the all band thing and then four vocals that all have to sing. Yeah, I didn't write anything. I just went, I'm out until I get this done. Then it'll be nice to sit down in a quiet room with a guitar and a blank piece of paper, you know, because I can write all the experiences I've just had in the studio.
Well, plus it gives you a time to try something new. And when you go back to songwriting, it's like a fresh moment for you.
Yeah. Yeah, because inevitably I'll hear some lick, some guitar player, or somebody's overdubbing something, and I'll go, yeah, that's a great lick. And then I go play the lick somewhere and change it. And the next thing you know, I'm in the middle of writing a song.
Well, you mentioned that when you're in the studio and you get these experiences, so when you go back to writing, you've got these experiences to draw on. Do you have examples you can give us of one of those inspirations?
I think I did a thing a while back where just for fun, we threw a Get Joe on it, you know, just because we needed something that was just a little ear candy.
Can you go ahead and tell us what that is?
It sounds like a banjo, but it's played like a guitar. It has like a guitar neck on it. But when you play it, any guitar player can play it and make it sound like, you know, a banjo roll or something. You're not going to do any scrugs on it, but it's just that ear candy that goes on in the background. So we did that. So then that made me want to go, okay, I'd like to get one of those. But then I decided I didn't want to buy it. I had a friend that's a guitar player, and he goes, yeah, just take mine. So I borrowed his for a month or two and played around with it and came up with some ideas and then gave it back to him. I'm always looking for some way to twist your brain a little differently.
Absolutely. Well, it's like what you were saying with the accordion, where you, you know, might run it through an amp or something just to make it sound a little bit different than it would normally be.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. I mean, the first time I ever heard one of those was in Nashville. I don't think I've ever seen one outside of Nashville, actually.
Really?
So again, you go in the studio, you're writing these songs and you're working with these bands. Have you developed a preference? Do you prefer songwriting or producing?
Gosh, man, I love both. If I get on a great song, what I think's a great song, which what I pray is a good song, great song, I will just stay up all night. I mean, I'll just keep banging on it because I love it, you know. But at the same time, the next day I got to be in the studio. I go, I got to go because I love it. So to me, they're about the same. I love both of them. They're both different, but, you know, there's not one over the other for me. Plus, I know if I keep writing, I get to go to the studio for myself. Right. So that's good.
Which is always special, right?
It's its own reward, you know.
Right.
Write your own songs, go cut. Yeah,
hopefully more than one time.
Yeah.
So you got these relationships. Working in Nashville, it's a very community-driven town, and you have a lot of relationships at this point. Do you have any collaborations that you've had that have just stood out to you?
I think for me, one of my favorites, it's always been Max T. Barnes, because Max comes from such depth of music, from being the son of Max D. Barnes, you know, and so his whole life growing up in Nashville, it just blows me away. And then he and I hit it off writing together and having a good time together. And I just think Max is one of those guys I went, you know, this is what songwriting should be. You sit around and you come in, you got any ideas? What about this? Well, let's talk about the family. How's your dog? What's going on? And when you talk enough, you finally get to a place where you come up with an idea. In fact, I mean, this is the first time I ever wrote with Max T. Barnes. I wrote A Night to Remember. And I had had the idea over a Thanksgiving holiday, and the first ride after Thanksgiving was Max. And it was the first time he and I'd ever gotten together. And we got together and we wrote the song all the way through. And it was about noon, but it was real bluegrass. It was boom, chuck, boom, chuck, boom, boom, you know, and we went off to lunch to get to know each other better and came back in to get everything after lunch in the writer's room. And we said, well, let's play it one more time. So we played it back. And Max says, what do you think? And I said, I think it's good. It's just not what I had in my head when I came in the door this morning. And he said, well, what did you have in your head? And I said, I had this. And I was plating this riff. And he goes, well, let's write that. So we turned around after lunch and rewrote A Night to Remember. And it ended up being the one that Joe Diffie cut. So it's just a matter of don't give up on songs, man.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and Max was so great about going, let's do it. Let's start again. Here we go.
Are there any other challenges like that that have come up in a studio?
When an artist loves an idea, you have to figure out how to go, that's not the best idea, but he loves it. And so you got to figure out some way to say, okay, how do we get his idea down and then get him to do our idea down? So you just say, okay, do it your way. Here we go. 1, 2, 3, go. Let him do it his way and say, okay, just for giggles, sing it this way. Let's do it this way. And right. Record that and say, okay, now come in here and sit down. And we just sit down and go, we know you love that, but look how this sounds. It sounds great. You know, and it's just a matter of working with the artist to figure out a way to get it going. And sometimes you go, well, how do we compromise? You know, it is their project. So you have to lean on their creativity and what they want. You know?
Right. Is it ever a challenge for you to let an idea go?
Yeah, I think so. I always want the project to be the best it can be and the song to be the best it can be. But there comes a point when the artist who's going to be out there representing the song and representing the talent, you know, what he is, what he's got, you just have to kind of work with them. And if they're not going to bend on it, then you got to let them go, you know? And here's what I think about that, because unless there's a record label that you can go there and say, hey, A or B, because then you have somebody that's an arbitrator to go, hey, the B is better right. than the A. But when they're their own independent artists and they have their own label and they're doing all this stuff, you kind of have to let them do their thing. I think that's part of letting that artist be an artist.
Sure. No, I could see that. Well, you bring up record labels. Have you ever had any challenges working with a record label?
Not really, no. I've had some other people come in and do some stuff publishing-wise that we've had to work out compromises on. Just, you know, somebody wants to do a different version of a song and you have to say, okay, well, it's a derivative work and it gets into all that stuff. So it's just the business of it. You know?
So these days, what's a day in the life for you?
Well, I get up and I kind of do what I need to do around the house a little bit. And then I'll sit down and come up to the studio and work on a song and do some stuff. If I have an appointment with an artist or with Tom to look at a band or something, we plan all that. And then book writers. You know, I have some writing friends that we get together and still write. There's some young artists down on the road that I get together and write with, trying to write them a single. Everybody's looking for the next thing gets on the radio. So it's real flexible because you can just kind of do your thing. But what's most productive for me is I have a routine. You get up, do the routine. I was probably 10 times more productive as a songwriter when I had a publisher that said, hey, are you coming in today? What's the deal?
Right. You know? Yeah. Having some sort of schedule.
Yeah. 5-6 days a week, every day for them. You know, it gets better.
Well, you mentioned something in there that I thought was kind of interesting, that you and Tom get together and discuss bands that you're looking at. Yep. So are bands coming to you to be produced?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, through friends and through managers, we have some manager friends that will send us people. And every now and then we'll be somewhere and someone's got, hey, you should go hear this band or do that. But mainly right now, I think it seems to be more management bringing things to us, which is always good. They're believing we can do what they need.
So are you guys at a point now where you can be selective?
Yeah, I think we can always be selective. I don't think we would ever just take everything that came down the pike. We've looked at some things and go, they're good, but they're not ready. They need another year playing live together, or they need to be, you know, they're just not ready to come in and do that for us. Now, they can get somebody to go cut all their songs in the studio, but for what we're ready to do, we don't want to do that.
So when you're doing that and you're bringing a new band or a new artist into the studio, what are you able to give them that they wouldn't be able to get through somebody else? What does your team specialize in?
Yeah. One of the things that I think we're strong with is all the experience that Tom Harding has had recording everybody in the world, from B.B. King to whomever. You know, he brings all that. So that's positive. We actually look at the songs, because I'm a songwriter. I look at it and go, hey, what if you sang this here? What if you said this word here instead of that word there? You know, as a producer, you have some leeway to help a writer kind of tighten up the song. And so we do some of that. And then sometimes I've got artists that'll come in and say, I got this half finished. Can we finish it? We'll sit in the studio and finish the song, you know, and get it right for the project. That's kind of how we work it. He's the technical guy, and I kind of work in the creative area with the singers and the songwriters and try to pull it down. And then he and I'll sit down and listen to it when they're gone and go, did we miss it? Did we get it? What's the deal?
So when you're helping the boat, is there a certain point in the process where you think you now deserve credit?
Yes, there is. I'm pretty, I believe there's a division between production and songwriting for sure. If it's a but instead of an and, if it's a if instead of a so, I mean, those kind of things, nah, I'm not going to worry about that. But if there's no second verse and he said, well, I need to write a second verse, then we sit down and say, okay, this is where I go into writer mode. And if I do that, you know, it's a co-write. And I'm real upfront about it. They go, yeah, let's do it. Let's knock it out. So to me, it's a little bigger to claim writer stuff. You have to do more work to the song, you know, because any producer can say, don't sing that word, sing this word. Right. And that's not a rewrite.
A lot of people do that and look for the credit.
Yes, they do. But I'm a songwriter. So I won't do that to a songwriter. So.
Right. Yeah. No, that's the right attitude to have. Now, how does that affect your relationship with Tom?
Oh, Tom's cool with it. He digs it. He said, yeah, whatever it takes. So we just have a great working relationship.
Is that relationship, is that something that you guys have discussed in advance?
We have talked about the part that songwriting is songwriting and it's separate than what we do. And to him, he's told me he feels like what we do is with plus for most writer artists, because he can say to an artist, and I can too, hey, if they're not perfect yet, we can help get them perfect. And he's all about that, saying, man, let's make the writer part of the deal work. I don't think we're to a place where we might do a publishing company, but we don't know yet. We're waiting to see if we can take this thing off.
Being upfront in a relationship like that, being upfront in any relationship is the best thing for you guys to do. Yep. But I know that's a struggle that a lot of people have in Nashville, because publishing is where the money's at. And when you're doing a project, that's usually a one-time paycheck, right, where publishing could potentially keep paying after that. So I'm glad to hear that you guys have that kind of relationship.
Yeah. I think that's just a thing. Everybody needs to sit down and talk it out. You know, what about this? What about that? Work it out. Tom and I have been friends for 100 years, so we know how to talk all that stuff out.
Well, it's hard to bring all those things up because you can't think of every scenario that's going to come up to put on the table beforehand. Right. But if you discuss them as they come up and yeah, before the actual process starts, I think that's, at least if anything else, it's the right thing to do.
Sure, it is.
So you're talking about writing and you're doing these projects and you're writing with these artists. Do you ever get to a point where you might get stumped, a little bit of writer's block?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think that's part of the deal, is you stare at the paper long enough, you think you'll never write anything again.
Right.
Usually when I get to writer's block, I'd get up and go do something. Fishing is always good, you know, something that kind of gets me away from staring at it or being in the studio or something and relax. It's not brain surgery. No one's going to die if you don't get it done. So give yourself a break and take a break.
Now, when you're doing these projects on your own and you're the one producing these projects, it might be a little bit easier for you to go ahead and take time to take a break or go fishing and refresh the batteries. Right. But do you ever find a situation where you just have to push through?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, there are lots of times when you're just going, okay, we just have to, we have to take a break and find a way to refresh before we come back in and just keep doing it. I think because I've done jingle writing and done some stuff for movies and things that you're, you know, commissioned to write, you know, you want a song about a bank, you give me a half an hour and I'll send you one. You know, but it's a little different when you're trying to create something that you want it to be the next song that gets sung for the next 10 years. And sometimes you think too much. I do. And say, don't worry about whether it gets sung in 10 years. Just write a really good song and have some fun.
Right. Now, when you're talking about that, I mean, we talk about publishing companies, and you mentioned earlier song pluggers and that type of thing. Have you noticed any differences these days, any different trends that we should be aware of?
Well, I think the new thing for songwriters, I think there's two things, the way to look at it. If you're a songwriter who's signed to a publishing company with pluggers and all that, there's still some of that traditional way of doing song plugging. But then there's also send it email it to me as an attachment, or, you know, give me your Spotify list or whatever, you know, and that's where they go listen to stuff now. Mm-hmm. If you're lucky, you'll get to sit down with somebody and play them a song, but usually they say, just send me an email and I'll let you know if I like it. And so that's the difference. It's a lot less personal. I mean, it's a lot. I mean, it's crazy that you don't get to go sit down across the desk from someone. But at the same time, it's kind of instant gratification because they'll come back and go, hey, close, but not that one. Send another. And you're like, right. Okay, I'll take that. You know. So I think internet has changed it.
Yeah, no, I could see that. Yeah. And you say sitting across the desk from somebody. When you do that, is it sitting across the desk listening to a demo, or is it sitting there with a guitar and playing it for somebody?
I know that depends. Usually what I do is it's always done with a CD and a lyric sheet. I mean, they don't always want the lyric sheet, but you got to have it even if they don't ask for it. Because a lot of time they go, I'd rather have it. I'm kind of weird. I'd like for them not to have a lyric sheet. You know, I like from listening to the song. So I always push those demo vocals about 2 or 3 dB more up so they don't have to ask for a lyric sheet. But yeah, I mean, it's fun to sit across. It's kind of fun. Sometimes it's not fun. I think it's fun if you know them well, but if you come in there and you have weak songs, it's not fun. You got to know you have a good song. You know?
I can only imagine, right?
Luckily for me, because there are always song pluggers, I'm not a good song plugger. Because I'll just go, okay, well, if you don't like it, thanks. And I'll walk out. Whereas a good song player goes, no, play that again, you know. So it's easier to have someone that didn't write it pitch the song.
Oh, absolutely. Hands down. It's hard to be the person who wrote it and push it, or the person who produced it and push it, because you're always going to have that bias. First of all, you're always going to think it's the best thing ever and that they're nuts. But second of all, it's a lot easier to push somebody else's stuff than it is to push your own stuff.
Yep.
I think you get a little bit more credibility that way, too.
I think you're right. Absolutely.
So what kind of technology changes have you seen inside the studio?
Well, of course, you're asking a guy who just spent a week taking ADATs down from an ADAT machine into Pro Tools. So right now, it's just, I'm a creative guy in the studio. I like to put the stuff on the thing and I'll be honest with you, every plugin that comes down the pike, I just don't have time to play with that. And it's not my love. And that's what Tom Harding is so good at. Because I'll call him up and go, hey, have you tried the plugin for this? He goes, yeah, it's a wonderful go. And I went, okay. You know, so that's for me, is the new stuff comes from Tom.
That's funny. No, I'm with Tom. I like to try all the new toys, the new gadgets, and see what works, what doesn't. But like you said, it takes time.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time, takes a lot of money. Yeah. So, all right, sir. Well, we do this thing here we call Unsung Heroes, where we take a moment to shine the light on somebody who works behind the scenes, somebody who may have supported you along the way. Is there anybody who works behind the scenes for you? And it could even be a family member or somebody that doesn't typically get any credit that you'd like to shine a little light on.
Sure. And I think there have been several people, you know, as you go through this business and you go to different places, you're going to find several people that will always be your heroes. One guy that I first really got involved with and followed up was a gentleman named Rod Parkin. And he started off in the tape room at a publishing company, worked his way to being the song plugger, worked his way to being the, you know, head of A&R at this, you know, place. And it's just one of those guys that just, I went, you know, he worked it, you know, from day one. And he was good at it. And he's one of those guys that was my inspiration when I was at Pier, because I was going, I dig Rod. So I think there are people like that. I always like people in the background that are working hard. I like engineers. Ryan Griffin's a guy I dig. You know, there are a lot of people in the background. I can just go down the list because I depend on all those people to make things work. Players, man, I love players that are great. Got a list of them because they're all so wonderful here in Nashville.
Now, I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. TW is not only a great writer, but he's an amazing guy. So please, join me in giving him a big thanks for taking the time to share his stories with us. And thank you for taking the time to hang with me here. I really do appreciate it. Please follow, share, connect on all the socials. You can do that and find everything mentioned over at jfranzi.com/episode37. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Jay Franzi Show. Make sure you visit us at jfranzi.com. Follow, connect, and say hello.
This episode has been brought to you by VR Knives, your source for 100% custom knives made by a true rock star. So, if you're in the market for a new piece of art, reach out to VR Knives. 407-421-5528. 407-421-5528.